You are listening to the INCJ podcast, Conversations about International Criminal Justice.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to our International Network Criminal Justice podcast. And this is the third episode in a series called Just Psychology, when leading international psychologists from around the world are invited to examine important justice issues and bring their particular perspectives to bear on conversation with Professor Joe Clark from the United Kingdom. My name's John Scott, and my job is really simple. I just have to chair the podcast and keep the conversation moving. Our subject today is forensic psychology across the pond. So we're going to get perspectives from the United States and from the UK. And we want to look at what it's like to work and train in such different jurisdictions. Now, we're hoping for a lively session, perhaps not to recent White House standards, but you never know. So what we're going to do is we're going to go around the virtual table and ask everybody to say something about where they're working and what their background and current interests are. So let's start with Julie Oliver. Julie, say something about where you're from and what you do.
So I am from the U.S. I currently work for the state of Georgia at the Department of Behavioral Health and Developmental Disabilities. I'm the state forensic director. I've been with the department for approaching 20 years. I started as a psychology postdoctoral student and then worked my way through licensure and stayed on to be worked both in the hospital system and as an outpatient evaluator and now for the state office. We are the state mental health authority, so it is a state agency, just a government agency that I work for. And that's where my perspective is going to be coming from. Try to think of what else. I did some training in the state and federal prison system going through graduate school. So I have a correctional background as well as the forensic piece. And current interest, I didn't know if you want to hear about like long walks on the beach or something like that, but I would like to one day be able to consider myself a runner, but I'm not there yet. So that's what I've been focusing on in my free time. But related to work, I'm really trying to focus a lot of energy on the process of getting access to treatment for individuals versus prosecution. So where can we divert people away from the criminal justice system when it's appropriate? So I'm spending a lot of time looking at how other states and other areas are addressing that issue.
Great. Well, welcome. It's lovely to have you with us. So let's move on to Nick Bowes. Tell us about yourself, Nick.
So hi, I'm Nick. Thank you for having me. Really interested to be part of today's session. I work at Cardiff Metropolitan University. I run the practitioner training program there for forensic psychologists. And I've been there over 15 years. I'm doing the maths, around 15 years. And I also do some work in clinical practice on a Wednesday. I work to one of the offender personality disorder pathway teams that cover Wales. My current interests are, I'm really interested in co-creation, so co-creating research with people who are held in forensic settings. So we're listening to the stuff that's important to them and not doing that thing that researchers can do, which is a bit like when the council sends you a questionnaire asking you what you think of their services and kind of they don't ask you the right questions. So I'm really interested in how we can get busy with asking the questions that matter most to people who are held in our services. And also we've just... we just won a tender for a project along with some other organisations in Wales looking at the very first steps for exploring devolution of justice to Wales, which is really exciting. So really interested in that. It's quite, it happened in Scotland a few years ago, but it's quite rare to kind of see something like that happening. So really interested to be part of that. And thank you for having me today.
Well, really good to have your perspectives and coming a Welsh one too, which is great. Joe, tell us where you are and what your current interests are.
Well, I currently have very little to do with forensic psychology, in fact, although my interest and my heart still remain in that area. And interestingly, just recently have been involved in writing a couple of articles about how being inside the mind of offenders has led to my current work, which is ensuring well-being and thriving for staff in any profession. And there is a link, but we probably won't talk about that today. So nowadays, I run a small non-for-profit business which specializes in helping people thrive at work and at life. And that came from 20 years in forensic psychology, starting off as a psychologist in Her Majesty's at that point prison service, now HMPPS. And I moved on from there about 15 years ago to an academic post at the University of York. And Petros is my small business is about 13 years old this year. I do still work in prisons supporting staff, and I'm very involved in training, particularly of new recruits and of managers in forensic settings. So my interest remains very much around how do we help people thrive in that job, because it is a very difficult job. And if staff aren't thriving, it's very difficult to provide effective services to our client base, whether they be in prisons or in the community. So that's where I come from today. But I also just like to add, I have had the privilege of having worked in America as well, in a number of different realms. One, working directly with staff in a civil commitment centre for men not yet ready for release who were living in the centre, but also evaluating programs in a different civil commitment center in a different state. So evaluating videos of treatment programs. And it's my experience is they're very different places to work. So I'm really looking forward to this conversation.
Yeah, I suspect that it's going to be the differences which we'll be drawing out that will be fascinating to listeners, whether it be in North America or in Europe. So I shall hope to be drawing out those and finding out what they are. But let's start with you three, because you strike me as quite different personalities. And I want to find out, well, how did you end up being forensic psychologist? Nick, what drew you to this as a profession?
Oh, gosh. So for me, it was quite by accident. So I had left school at 16 and gone and done YTS, which existed back then for British Gas. And so completely had no intention of going to university. It didn't occur to me that that would be appropriate at 16, go and earn some cash. But my gran, who was really important in my early experience, kind of my primary person, if you like, she got diagnosed with Alzheimer's. And so that sparked my interest really into psychology. And I intended to kind of follow that route to look at, I guess, kind of, you know, what psychologists couldn't. So I went back anyway, took redundancy from British Gas, went back to do A-levels, went to university with the intention of going to do clinical psychology, possibly neuropsychology. And I applied for forensic psychology because I thought it would be really good experience along the way. And I accidentally, if you like, kind of got offered a post. So I moved from Yorkshire, from all my family, down to Wales to do my training, and I loved it and stayed since. I had a bit of a background in youth work, so I suppose I kind of connected with that sense of that connected with me as well. And kind of a bit of a meandering answer there. But again, I trained in Her Majesty's Prison Service, as it was back then as well, so similar to Joe.
Okay. Julie, were you called to be a forensic psychologist? What was your route into the job?
I was not. I'm surprised that I'm here, because I wasn't pursuing to be a forensic psychologist. I was always good in math and science, so I was going to go to school for biomedical engineering, and then I chose pre-med. So when I went off to graduate school, I really thought that that was going to be where I'd end up. Eventually, it just didn't feel right for me. I thought maybe I would pursue psychiatry. And then I switched over to psychology. So my mom was really excited to know that I was going to be a physician and then switched over to psychologist. But it felt like a good fit for me, so I pursued it. I didn't really know that I wanted to be a forensic psychologist until years later. And it took me, I think, 3 times of applying for graduate school before I was accepted. And I think it's because I didn't really know what I wanted to pursue. At one point, I wanted to work with girls with eating disorders, and then I was looking at doing more adult work. And I really, when I would apply, I didn't really have a focus. And I think that showed and then why I wasn't selected. But the strange thing for me is I got on a plane. I don't know where I was going, but someone left a book in the little pocket behind the seat. And it happened to be a book about a forensic psychologist. So I read it on my flight. And then I was like, that's it. That's what I want to do. And that's how I chose to pursue forensic psychology. So I kind of, like Nick, I kind of lucked into this situation, I think.
Extraordinary. Now, Joe, you clearly are now going to tell us that it was all mapped out for you.
Yeah, no, I was going to be an equine behaviourist. I was going to work with horses. My first PhD offer was on the Isle of Mull studying horse behaviour. And I loved Julie's introduction about, you know, being an aspiring runner, and I'm an aspiring equestrian. I've ridden all my life, and I'm quite glad actually that my hobby didn't become my job, looking back on reflection. So I fell into it too. It was, you know, the first job that I was offered was working with offenders in the community. And there had been an advertisement for prison psychologists, but I had not felt ready. And that's very interesting when we're talking about neuroscience. It's a subject that fascinates me. I don't think I realized at 23, scientifically, my brain wasn't fully formed, but psychologically, I certainly didn't feel ready to work in a prison. Mm. And I came to it at 25, and I still think that's too young, but still. So I sort of fell into it too. I should add, so as not to completely distress the professional body of forensic psychologists, the HCPC, that I am no longer a forensic psychologist. I'm not registered with them. So I'm a chartered consultant psychologist, just to put the record straight in case it upsets anybody.
Well, we're here to upset people.
It's very important.
We're here to make people think. Okay. So it strikes me that therefore, as a profession, it's not one that waves a flag and people very readily are drawn to. It's maybe something that people who have a psychology approach mature into, but maybe we'll have to think about that. So what's the training route then? And is it different between America and the UK? So Julie, how do you become a forensic psychologist in America?
So you have to get your undergraduate degree, the four-year degree of your bachelor's, and then you have to get a doctorate degree. Some of the programs have a terminal master's program, but others you get it along the way, with the fifth year being your internship. And then you have to do a one-year postdoctoral supervised work hours to then apply for licensure. So I would imagine it's very similar, but I'm curious to hear if there are differences.
Okay, so let's hear about the differences from Nick.
So it is quite similar. So you do have to have an undergrad first, and then you have to do a master's qualification. So undergrad, we've got levels in the UK. So undergrad takes you to level 6, if you like. Master's qualification is level 7. And beyond that, then you, and those are, have to be BPS accredited, both of those. So your undergrad would be generic psychology, psychological theory. Master's would be specifically in forensic psychology. And then you go on to practitioner training. And there's a number of routes. So you need to look for an approved HCPC, who are our regulatory body, approved education provider. And they run then, there's a number of qualification routes in. I would say, I don't think there's any route that's less than 2 years for that. So if you add those up, some people do a master's in 1 year, some people do it in 2 years, but you're looking at least 7 years training for people to become a forensic psychologist, at least. Most people would be 9.
Okay, so that's 9, including an undergraduate program. Okay.
Yes, yeah, typically undergrad 3 years, master's 1 to 2 years, and then practitioner training 2-ish to 3 years, okay. And some people a bit longer.
Okay. And would 9 years from start be about the same in America, Julie?
It is, yes.
Wow.
So, yes, 4 years undergrad.
Question.
Sure.
Yeah, because would it be the same in every state, Julie? Or if you move states, would you have to qualify or meet other criteria?
The licensing boards for each state might be a little bit different, but they all follow similar. The accreditation you were talking about, we have the American Psychological Association accreditation for programs and internships and postdocs. So they're some of the very similar things by state, but it might be just a little bit different. So I'm licensed in Georgia and in Florida, I didn't have to go through the hoops for Florida just because I'd been a practitioner for 10 years. So they just accepted that Georgia license. I don't think it's very different across states, but I haven't applied to any, you know, beyond Florida and Georgia.
Okay. So can I ask a question, if people know, if Nick, if you wanted to go and practice in France, would your qualifications be recognized in another European state?
So no, and actually forensic psychology, so we've got a strange situation across Europe where there's a kind of body called EFPA, European Federation of Psychological Associations, where nations across Europe kind of join together, and that's been really driven by our occupational psychologists, so because there's a lot of kind of business practice, I guess, that crosses over nations, and so you can have a title of Eurosci, but that doesn't allow you to practice in the various countries. And in fact, across Europe, there are not many countries where you'll find forensic psychologists. So we are in the EFPA standards, we come under other. So there's like clinical psychologists, occupational psychologists, we're just under other. So it wouldn't, as far as I know. And also, I've had some friends move over to Canada and to the US, and I think it's quite convoluted, their ability to kind of practice over there as well. So yeah, it's strange how that works. If you think about the length of time people qualify, it's longer than medicine or dentistry, and yet doctors and dentists can kind of practice across different nations. It's I guess there's understanding the legal systems and stuff like that. They're important. It keeps us a bit parochial, I guess.
Yeah, but more than that, it says to me that the function and role of forensic psychology is not regarded as important in some European states. And if it's not fully developed, it's because they maybe don't recognize the need for psychology working alongside prisoners or alongside probation.
So I think you'll probably, we do have psychologists working into most prisons across Europe, I would say, but often they qualify as clinical psychologists and work in those settings. So the actual modality of forensic psychology is something that's quite, I don't want to say unique because it isn't unique, but it's not as broad as clinical psychology across Europe or across the world even.
Okay. And Julie, go.
Is there a degree in forensic psychology there? Because ours is all clinical psychology, and then you have to specialize in forensics. So we don't really have a title of forensic psychologist. By degree is our working title.
Mm. So we have master's degrees in forensic. There are actually some undergrad degrees, but I think the BPS are trying to filter those out. So our at master's level, so beyond undergrad level, that's where people seem to specialise in. That's the system that it has been in the UK. And it's a bit artificial, really, because once you get past master's stage, you've got the HCPC, it's kind of our system's disjointed. The BPS look after everyone up to master's, and then the HCPC look after everyone on the practitioner training beyond that, and then we've got these standards of proficiency that all the practitioner psychologists have to meet, and there's very little difference between what a forensic psychologist has to do and demonstrate, what a clinical psychologist has to demonstrate, what a counselling psychologist has to demonstrate. But we still tend to be in our little kind of, you know, we're in our lanes, you know, and it's a shame because like I say, we're all trained and have to demonstrate really, really similar competences, and we could really benefit through some cross work in there. It's a bit trickier to train in the UK as a forensic psychologist. There's no proper funded route for that. So if you're training in clinical psychology, you get a salary. You know, there's a proper training route to paid with that. Forensic psychologists in the UK may have some sponsorship from their organisation to undertake training, but there's no formal, you know, kind of training route that's paid for by the health service, for example, like there are clinical psychologists in the UK.
Okay, Joe wanted to come in.
Yeah, I'm just was reflecting as I listened to this about how new the term forensic psychology is. Certainly when I joined the prison service, my master's degree was in criminological psychology, and the HCPC, I don't think had been thought about in the context of practicing forensic psychologists at that point. And I can't remember when it switched to forensic psychology, but probably 20 years ago, it wasn't that long. Mm-hmm. So I'm in some respects not surprised to hear that there are different protocols in different European countries, although certainly I've worked with psychologists in a range of European countries, from the sort of Eastern Europe and Western Europe, and there are certainly psychologists working there, but they don't have the issues with the titles that we have. And I totally agree with Nick that the skills of psychology are very general in terms of counselling, occupational, forensic, clinical. And we probably need to be a little bit more relaxed and less defensive about what we call ourselves. Although I do like the title forensic psychology. I think it's a nice job title, even though I can't use it.
As the non-specialist here, there's a precision about the title, which I think is helpful. I'm going to change the subject a bit. Let's move us on. If you meet someone at a party or at a coffee table and you tell them you're a forensic psychologist, how do you explain what forensic psychologists do? Julie, how do you explain what the role is?
Normally, when someone finds out what I do, they think I'm looking at dead bodies and they think of it, the CSI TV show. And I have to explain that that's not at all what I do for a living. And I try to keep it short and sweet and really focus for it. With the department that I'm in, our role is really narrow. We have a lot of work to do, but what we do is specifically competency to stand trial, evaluation, so mental state currently, to see if someone can work with their attorney in their own defense. We also do the degree of criminal responsibility evaluations, or not guilty by reason of insanity, which would be assessing mental state at the time of the crime. So we do the evaluations, court testimony, and then if individuals are ordered into our hospital system, we do the treatment to restore them to competency so they can be returned to jail and go back to trial. Or if they're not guilty by reason of insanity, we are treating them to the point that we feel like they can be safely placed in the community. So that is the briefest version that I can give when I explain to folks what I do for a living. There are a lot of other parts to that, but that's it.
So can I just check? That's really quite precise around assessment, court-based, providing reports, and then interventions to try to move people on so that they can receive treatments and make progress. Have I understood that right?
That's the role within our department. Now, we have forensic psychologists in the U.S. who do other work, and I think Joe was maybe hinting at some of this. We have like sexually violent predator, some states, Georgia does not have it, where they civilly commit people who have sex offenses. Even if they've already served their term of incarceration, they can be civilly committed. So we have forensic psychologists who do that work. There are others that are hired to do like child custody evaluations, civil work. So there are other areas for forensic psychology in the States, but my focus is really the criminal courts and that evaluation and treatment piece.
Okay, right. Really helpful. Nick, how do you explain your role at the party?
Yeah, I agree with you. Usually I don't tell people, if they find out, it's the same. And it's really funny because we went to do some work with the University of Florida and they did a schedule for us. So they knew we were forensic psychologists. And that is exactly what they set up, is this kind of crisis where they'd got people who donated their body to medical science, and they'd established this kind of a terrorist scene in and around their gymnasium in scorching heat with little bits of cut up body that had been scattered everywhere. And their job was to try and pick these, kind of put the people back together. That was a practice event. And so we were there just kind of like, oh my goodness, there's a finger. So that's really funny because people do think that. I often talk, I guess, in terms of, because people are really interested, I think. It's like, oh, that sounds amazing, really interesting. I bet you hear some stories. And I think I try to kind of talk about just how sad a lot of our work is. It's often, you're often dealing with a lot of trauma stories, if you like. So people's lives have been really challenging and difficult. So harm, they have been harmed and also cause harm, a lot of the people that we work with. And I guess kind of academically, I'd say across the practitioner psychologists, that's what we do. We engage in this process of assessment, psychological assessment, psychological interventions of various types. They could be, kind of directly with someone, or they could be environmental kind of systemic work around a person. And then we kind of evaluate kind of how that's going. We do some research around that, hopefully publish. We offer a bit of consultancy work and some teaching and training to kind of try and help to establish a more psychologically informed environment. And that's what all psychologists follow, not just forensic psychologists. And I guess for our guys, we tend to focus on behaviour that crosses the law. So, kind of where there's a legal aspect to the behaviour that is seen as problematic, I guess, kind of, or our target.
It strikes me that there are different roles for forensic psychologists in different organisations. So we've talked a bit about prisons, but presumably forensic psychology can be available for probation operations or youth justice organisations. I wonder if we could broaden it out to see how forensic psychology can contribute in different settings. Joe, can you contribute to that?
A little bit, but I suspect that Nick and Julie are probably more current. But I think one of the things people often think we do is crime scene analysis and prediction. They think we're part of the FBI and we can tell who did a crime by just looking at or sniffing the air or something. And there are so many TV programs like that, and there where people go in and create some kind of magic. But I think that there's a very interesting branch of psychology that doesn't get spoken about an enormous amount around investigative psychology and crime prediction. I think more and more we need to be thinking about forensic psychology's application to youngsters and diversion from justice. We would apply the principles of forensic psychology, which is also about working with people who have the psychological capacity to break laws, to become disinhibited, to fight authority. And so we have a lot of skills in that perhaps other areas of psychology don't have. I think your average occupational psychologist doesn't generally come across people who are habitually disinhibited or law breaking. And I think we need to think much more about the application of our skills to young people to divert them away from criminal justice, because we teachers in schools are probably the best predictors of risk of a criminal justice trajectory than anybody. And I think we ought to be applying our resources there. So that's an area I don't think we do necessarily focus on, but probably should. You've mentioned probation and community-based settings. And Julie mentioned civil work as well. And I've had colleagues who've done more and more civil work. So that might be, as you say, family assessments to see if parents are capable of looking after their child, whether or not there's a risk of offending in the family and the risk to the children. So there are so many areas, I think, that forensic psychology specifically, but clinical psychologists also should be focusing and could focus and probably do.
And Julie, in America, are psychologists used in community-based programs?
Community-based, not necessarily justice-involved individuals. I mean, we have a lot of community-based psychologists, but when I was thinking about the question with probation, I don't see a lot of work in that area. It's, they're on probation, they're supposed to follow the rules, and there's not that mental health support in there. It might be that they have to take substance abuse classes, but I'm not seeing an intervention from a forensic psychologist, like the risk mitigation or those kinds of things that we would be good at. Nothing was coming to mind when you asked that question. So it leads me to believe that we have a weakness in that area. But if I could, I see Joe raise her hand, but if I can piggyback on what you said, when you were talking about kind of working with the youth to prevent them from going through this trajectory, it made me think that our response currently is more reactive. We're evaluating post-crime. We're not doing that preventative work where I think that we could have a lot of input.
Okay. Let's stay with this, because I want to go to Nick and then we'll go to you, Joe. But Nick, because it strikes me that forensic psychology has a great deal to offer in understanding and setting up programs, whether it be offender education or structured approaches. And I know that probation programs are often informed by psychology. So could you perhaps say a little bit about that, and we'll bring Ben Joe in?
Yeah, I think like my practice that I do one day a week is in the community with probation staff who are working with men and women who meet the what we call a pathway, which is like a crossover between health and justice. So kind of where people have got, many of the people that we work with who are very high risk meet those, have got crossover between kind of needs for health and also needs justice wise. So yeah, I think we do have a big input there, and the pathways a really growing place for forensic psychologists to be employed. And I think I agree with you. I think that the focus on primary intervention, so intervention before people enter the justice system, become stigmatized on top of everything else, often the children are trying to cope with, because the majority of children who enter our services are children who are already traumatized, already facing extreme challenges to their survival. Their development has been impacted by some of their early life experiences. We call them ACEs, adverse childhood experiences, and they have ACEs aplenty, and they're struggling to survive. And then we whack them in the criminal justice system, where they mix with older people, perhaps more sophisticated in terms of offending behaviour, and they then have another. They've got 99 problems, and then we've got another one with stigmatization of being, I agree about the primary intervention. I don't know whether that answered your question then, though, John, because I was like,
Yeah, yeah. I think it did, because what you're saying is that psychologists were working alongside probation officers, and that's really what I wanted to say. Joe, you were itching to come in.
Yeah, I hope people listening to this podcast are enjoying it as much as I am listening to Nick and Julie, because it's sparking my brain so much. And one of the things at Petros we've recently taken on is support of an insurance company who are providing cover around safeguarding. And the forensic skills that have been ignited for me in looking at how we keep people safe in different settings has been really interesting, because obviously, this is safeguarding against abuse, and having an understanding of why people offend, why they abuse, and how we can prevent that has been absolutely central to the way we've approached the safeguarding aspects of Petros's work. So whilst you might not naturally consider a forensic psychologist being of benefit in safeguarding, I'm discovering there is a whole world of crossover. And, you know, we'll listen to people saying, well, you know, our safeguarding policies and procedures are marvellous. And I'll say, so are the rules of our country, but people still break them. You know, it doesn't matter how good your policies and procedures are. You will always have people who are able to push the boundaries to disinhibit themselves to offend or abuse vulnerable adults and young children and everyone else in between. So it's very interesting for me that I think there are many, many areas where the skills of forensic psychology could be very usefully applied, even though we might not naturally think of that setting. So that was just what got me thinking. So thank you, Nick and Junie.
I'm going to move us on a bit. You all worked in different settings, and I'm wanting to ask, is the crime the same in one side of the pond to the other? So are people that commit the crimes the same? So are the offenders that Julie and her staff assess the same as the offenders that Nick and her colleagues assess the same? What's the differences?
I'd be really happy to start this off, having had experience of working with both and actually finding it quite a shock. So I think culturally, the British naturally are much more reserved and slightly more inhibited in discussing anything. And I remember doing video monitoring of a civil commitment centre treatment group and being almost horrified by the detail that offenders went into regarding their offending compared with the offenders I'd worked with in the UK. And it was, I'm not sure why that is. I always, forgive the stereotype, but always see Americans much more flamboyant than the British. You know, we tend to be much more sort of stiff upper lip. And that seemed to really come across in offence accounts, which was very, very interesting. And I think the other thing to bear in mind that kind of supports that a bit more scientifically is that when we first started using the psychopathy assessments, there are different cutoff points for psychopathy in the UK compared with America. So there are differences, but that's sort of as far as my experience goes. I'd be really interested to hear what Nick and Julie have to say about that.
Okay, let's plunge into this. Differences. Julie, very graphic description, offenders, spilling the beans very quickly.
It happens. You know, the interesting thing is for a competency to stand trial evaluation, I don't need a confession. I don't need the details. I just need to know if they understand what they're charged with and what the potential punishment could be. So I don't try to elicit the details from individuals, and I might even cut them off. I don't want them to say anything that, you know, I might have to speak to in court. But there have been a handful of individuals who just feel, for whatever reason, compelled to give me the details. And those have been really graphic and pretty horrible situations. And honestly, I don't know if that was just someone who was trying to get it off their chest and admit that they did it, or if they were getting some kind of gratification and going over the details again. Like, I really am not sure. One person in particular stands out in my mind, but I don't typically try to go there. And if I don't need to go there in an interview, I will limit it. For criminal responsibility evaluations, we'll go into more detail about the crime because we have to assess that. But in my experience, many of those individuals are so embarrassed for what they've done, because to be not guilty by reason of insanity, you know, your mental health symptoms overmastered your will to resist committing this crime. So it's hard for them to really get into the details because they weren't thinking clearly and they don't want to admit that they were that mentally ill. So in those particular examinations, I'm not getting those illicit details. So that's been my experience.
So that's quite cloudy. There's a sort of a pull between embarrassment about how their mental health and their background is disturbing them, but at the same time, the horror of the offence is also getting in the way. Okay.
Yes.
That's really complex, and the skill to unwrap that and get to the truth must be very demanding, Julie.
It can be challenging at times, especially if, you know, for the not guilty by reason of insanity, that's an affirmative offense. So the person has to be willing to enter into that plea in court. So I might be evaluating someone who I think might meet that criteria, but they're downplaying that they were that sick or they didn't meet it. So it can be very challenging to do those evaluations. I mean, the criteria to be legally found not guilty by reason of insanity is very, very strict in Georgia, but what I find is that there are some really ill individuals who may not give me the information that I need to make that determination just because they're guarding themselves or not willing to pursue that plea option.
Yeah. Okay. Nick, can you explore this for us, please?
Yeah, I guess there's a few things I want to say. I think we have some commonalities. So I think we've got commonalities in terms of trajectory. So one of the kind of intervention research things I've been involved in is something called Lights for Violence, which was an intervention that was run in schools to try to promote healthy behaviour in children and to prevent dating violence, but with a real big focus on, you know, what does a healthy lifestyle look like for someone who's a teenager? And we delivered the same projects there across six different nations in Europe. So we've got kind of some cross, including Romania, that, you know, kind of, you know, so some quite different like cultural experiences there. So I think there's some commonalities in terms of what the trajectory looks like and what an intervention might look like. And I think there's some commonalities in terms of across nations generally on what meets the law. So someone committing a sexual offence in the UK, it's very likely that will overlap to what a sexual offence means and is in the United States. And the same with violence. I think what is really important for forensic psychologists as well is for us to be involved in policy and lawmaking. So if we look in recent years in the UK, we have a whole lot more behaviour that comes under new laws. So the terror laws, for example, is one set of those. So all of a sudden, we've got a subset of people whose behaviour isn't concerning, worrying. It's now illegal. And so like that's how countries, and that, and I guess that's what's unique about forensic psychology. It's almost what I was saying earlier, that you kind of need to know the jurisdiction in which you're working. Like what does the law look like? And I think one of the challenges for us as forensic psychologists is also to influence that. So we can't, there are some bad laws, I think, in the UK that frustrate me. One of the ones, for example, is arson, reckless as to whether or not life is endangered. And typically people who get that offence are people who've been discharged from health services, mental health services, want to end their life, set their flat on fire, and then end up being a criminal with a criminal conviction and a very long time in prison when their intention was not to harm anybody at all there, that their intention was to stop their own suffering. And so I won't get on my high horse about that, but I think there's a role for us to play in challenging and moving legislation forward and changing that. And it's one of the things that we were involved in around trying to change the indeterminate sentence for public protection, trying to, you know, which was kind of deemed like kind of to be against people's human rights, is to try and get the government to act to kind of make some changes for people facing that, which is actually been really strongly led in the UK by the families of people affected by IPP. So BPS were really late to the table, but I think, you know, kind of that should be our role as well, kind of not just pulling people out of the river, but looking further back up and seeing kind of what, you know, what's causing these problems. And sometimes it's poor legislation.
The BPS, everybody, is British Psychologists Society. Yeah. So what we're saying is crime might be the same, but offenders might be different. And different cultures impact and different laws impact. Joe, you wanted to come in.
Yeah, I was going to ask Julie about the age of criminal responsibility in America, because obviously the age of criminal responsibility here was reduced to 10 years old after the infamous Jamie Bulger murder. So I don't know if you know about this, Julie, but a two-year-old was murdered by two 10-year-old boys. And to try the children, the age of criminal responsibility dropped at that point to 10 years old. And I think given what we now know in neuroscience, that our brains aren't fully developed and everything else, personally, I still find that horrifying. I think there are other issues around gun availability in America, although we have our own issue with knife crime, and also in terms of the law deterrence and things like the death penalty, which we don't have here. And obviously not every state in America does. And I'm curious about the part that those things play. So the age of criminal responsibility, deterrence, and the role of guns in criminal behaviour.
Okay, so let's start age of responsibility.
This is an interesting question that I feel ill-prepared to answer because, no, it's okay, but this is good. It's an area that we're trying to look into, at least I say we being my department, and I'm speaking for Georgia specifically, in that it was until recently, we only did criminal responsibility evaluations for adults, and then there was a Georgia Supreme Court case that allowed for that to be expanded to juveniles. So now we're trying to figure out what that means, what happens to them if they are not guilty by reason of insanity, you know, their civil commitment, where they go, how we respond to them. And that's an area that we were just discussing yesterday. We're trying to get more training in to come into. So I couldn't sit here and tell you with confidence what the actual age is. And I apologize for that. But it is something that is on our horizon, I think, to address. And related to gun violence, so that is becoming more and more of a concern. We had a juvenile judge panel that they're really looking at what the information they get from our evaluations and the decisions they make in terms of where a youth might need to be housed while they're waiting for their case to be resolved. And there's a lot of pressure on the judges related to that gun safety issue and how to keep the community safe. But I don't know if that answers everything that you were thinking of, but that's what came to mind. If I could go a step back, though, one thought that I had when we were talking about if crime is different. One thing that I was thinking about when listening to the other responses in the work that I do, everything we do is reported back to the court. So there's going to be a little bit of reservation on behalf of the defendants to tell us things. But when I had my experience in the prison system, these people were already sentenced where I was doing mental health evaluations and therapy. I found that people were much more interested in telling me the details of their crimes there, but they had already been sentenced. So there was a little bit of difference there, and I didn't want to be misleading in my response.
Okay, thank you. I'm conscious we need to keep the subject moving. So if you're okay with that, let's move on a little, because I'd like to look at the role that psychologists have in developing methods of intervening with offenders and perhaps developing programs that can change behavior. Which methods do you think are most successful? Are there any interventions that can bring hope, and maybe any new areas of research where there's positive results that psychology can contribute to enabling offenders to change?
Go on, Nick.
Yeah, well, let's look at the professor to start.
It's a really good question. And it's one of the things I think that we've struggled with research wise as psychologists, and come under some pretty fair criticism for, because often, so if we think about kind of our criminology, and I think about criminology being our hairy brothers, I call them, and they're not brothers and they're not all hairy, but I kind of think about criminology being like the backdrop that we've come from. And criminology looks at they've got a different perspective than psychologists, when we're often thinking about individual, how does this individual change? What is the individual formulation here? And criminology are much more looking at a kind of group societal level about how things and systems work to support things like desistance, which you're kind of creating an identity away from crime. I think it's a really tricky answer. One thing I would say that I love, love, love seeing at the moment is an expansion of EMDR, which is a trauma reprocessing treatment, as part of a trajectory towards recovery for people who are in the criminal justice system. And it does take that approach that, you know, kind of the vast majority of people that we work with, I have worked with personally, have this long history of trauma, of chronic, repeated, unescapable traumatic experiences in their early life, which has set them on a trajectory towards the justice system. So because of that trauma, people haven't been able to engage in opportunities like education, no hobbies. No, they weren't part of the football team because literally their family was trying to survive. All of the opportunities that we would like to think about, perhaps we had as children, that we want our children to have, those children often did not have. And so there's a need for us to think about what has life looked like for this person before we start teaching them not to bash someone else, if you like. So there's a sense of that person brings with them this big sea ocean of trauma. And actually what we're asking them to do is think about the one time that they threatened someone to get some money out of the tilt, kind of. And in the scheme of things for them, it's really hard to shift that focus from what's happened to them to what did they do to someone else, because they don't have, in a sense, they don't have space to start thinking about how their behaviours affected someone else, because they are carrying this stuff that they have. And very often that trauma is, like I said at the beginning, kind of people who are harmed often harm. And so EMDR has been implemented with a range of different people across the estate. So with children, women, men, and as almost like part of the journey towards recovery. So can we treat the trauma first? Then do we have some space now to start thinking about substance misuse, which is often people have trauma. Alcohol, substances are actually in some ways really good drugs to use, because it stops them thinking about the trauma. They get into this pattern. So often that sense of like, actually, let's treat the trauma, then we start looking at those other things. For my really long answer.
Yeah, no, it's okay. What does EMDR stand for?
Eye movement desensitization.
Regimen.
Okay. It's just that we've got people out there that won't know. Okay,
Yeah.
So
eye movement desensitization, reprocessing. EMDR, eye movement reprocessing, EMDR. Oh, let me tell you properly, because I really should know that.
Yeah, we'll look that up and let you know, everybody. Okay, so that's
desensitization and reprocessing.
Desensitization. Yeah. Okay, so that's engaging with the whole person, and that's using psychological methodologies. Great. Joe, what do you think, sort of what works?
But you know, as you were talking, Nick, I was thinking back to the old days when we first started introducing offending behaviour programmes into prisons, and they were very psychologically driven, very well intended, overseen by expert panels. And I look back on that, and you know, thankfully we can learn and develop as well. I do think some of those programmes are really helpful. I think there was a lot of imposition on offenders without considering the whole person. And I totally agree with Nick. You can give someone all the skills in the world in prison about how to problem solve or how to take perspective or how to, manage their emotions. And then you put them out in the real world where, you know, their partner's just insulted them and their parents have let them down again, if they're still in touch with their parents and so on. And all the skills go out the window. I think the other thing that we know therapeutically, and we know this from other branches of psychology as well, is that one of the most important elements of effective treatment is relationship with the therapist, inverted commas. Mm-hmm. And I've come to value that so much outside of a prison setting, where I know that if I'm on the right level with somebody, I'm going to be much more effective in the use of my skills than if I don't have a connection. And that's really hard on psychologists in prisons as well, because it's the boundary issue is so crucial. And very often youngsters with ACEs, as Nick has talked about, the adverse childhood experiences, have never had boundaries imposed and don't understand them. So it's a really, really complex, complex area. And I think psychologically informed approaches are absolutely critical. I think we have to have an understanding of how the human mind works if we are going to support people to make change, but that has to be done in the context of education, of hobbies, of family, of relationships, of the community they live in. Mm-hmm. And if we're going to do these psychological interventions in prison and then put someone right back in the environment they were in when they offended, frankly, I think we're wasting our money. We need a much more holistic approach to supporting people long term, and ideally, in my world, intervening very early. Prevention is always better than cure.
So reintegration isn't just doing a program in a dry setting in a prison. Okay.
Virtual reality and AI might have a really important role to play in the way we work psychologically in future.
There's quite a lot of work going on with that.
Yeah.
Julie, what about in America? Are there research and new methods that we can learn about from America?
I'm thinking of the work that I do, and I feel like the population is a little bit different. But I'm thinking about the people who are incompetent to stand trial. Our treatment intervention is to get them competent. So they really, it's medication management. Do they understand the roles of the court? Can they work with their attorney? So it's a very narrow intervention, and then they go on with their case. While we have them, we try to help them understand how to, participate in more pro-social activities to try to prevent recidivism. But our mission is to get them competent. So that, that's very limited. For the people who are not guilty by reason of insanity, or those who are incompetent to stand trial, who don't get restored, we're really focusing on teaching them how to live with their mental illness and manage their symptoms. We have, over the past, 10 years, really focused more on the trauma so we can help them understand their history and how they ended up where they are. But a lot of what we're doing is teaching them how to, use a computer, use a cell phone, just the basic skills, because many of our people have been incarcerated or hospitalized for so long. They just don't have there's the basic living skills. So that's a big focus of what we do for, the work that I'm doing, not necessarily as connected to what we are doing as a country for the post release from prison, how we're enabling people to prepare better to not be rearrested. So I can't really speak to that personally.
Okay. Thank you. That was really interesting. And also, we're looking at differences, and the focus of your role and job is different. Okay. We talked earlier that you're meeting, through the role of a forensic psychologist, difficult people often really tough times in their lives, and you see and hear very challenging stories. And what do you think are the toughest aspects of being a forensic psychologist, and how do you look after yourself in the role? Joe, I think this is one of the areas taken lots of work.
Yeah, I mean, this has been my focus really for the last 25 years. I think being immersed in other people's trauma and being able to manage that professionally and hold your own boundaries takes an enormous amount of skill and energy to not burn out, you know, to have longevity in the field. And if we're going to build relationships with offenders, to work with them, to reduce recidivism, we need people who have been in the field a long time. So I think it's really important to prepare people, forensic psychologists and other criminal justice staff, for the trauma that they are likely to experience. And that might be direct trauma, you know, by difficult interactions with offenders, but it might be vicarious trauma, secondary trauma, compassion fatigue. In a way, it doesn't really matter what we call it, because it's all horrible. I think to ensure that we can have people in the field for a long time, we need to prepare them very well for the role and to help us understand what we're going to be exposed to. Because whilst we might not have had those early adverse childhood experiences ourselves, we sure as day is day, we're going to be exposed to other people's. That's so proper training, proper support, training in skills to look after yourself, for example, how to manage your energy, understand how your mind works, when you might likely be more vulnerable, perhaps. So, for example, if you become a parent in the middle of your career, or you lose somebody, or you have a parent in care, and then you come across an offender who abused or killed a parent in care, when things become personal, it can impact you much more than when we have more distance, more detachment from it. So to ensure that our organizations understand us and can support us and have a culture where distress is understood, accepted, and the expression of it encouraged. I mean, I could go on forever about the things that we can do around the toughest parts of the job, but I think being exposed to other people's stories and being taking their journey with them, which is a good psychologist in that aspect of the work you would do. I mean, Nick's alluded to the fact that we work in lots of other fields as well, and Julie works in different fields again, but if you are going to be working therapeutically with offenders, that's really important. It would be lovely to see a cohort of forensic psychologists who focus specifically on how to look after their colleagues. I'd love that. But I'll stop there.
Yeah, Julie, how have you looked after yourself in a role?
It's an interesting question, because in listening to Joe, I agree with everything she said, but it's funny because I don't know where I developed the skill set to navigate all those situations and the things that you hear. You just kind of adapt. I mean, I did a lot of independent studying about boundaries, which to me, it seems like it should be part of every graduate program for anyone who's going to work with offenders, but I don't recall ever hearing about it. And so I had to teach myself on how to do that, and it's something that I'm very passionate about, and I couldn't agree more about being sensitive to the work that you're doing, especially when your own boundaries might be a little more permeable. If you have something going on in your life, it can be very challenging to approach the job in the way that you're used to doing. So I think primarily what I do is just talk through. I'm a talker, so I talk to my colleagues. We've develop kind of strange senses of humor to adapt to the work that we do. And I think everyone, I see you nodding, because I think everyone will agree that forensic psychologists can be a little weird in that way. But it helps you cope. I'm just trying to compartmentalize. Work is work. Acknowledge when work is permeating into your personal life. Do something so that doesn't sustain itself and cause you issues. And then find your hobbies and passion and things that make you happy in between your work hours.
Nick, could you how you look after yourself?
So I don't think I'm very good at this, and I don't know whether to talk about what I don't I think I'm more aware of it for my role in training others, but I don't think I model it well. So I think I would say the way I look after myself is I'm very lucky because I've got a tight group of friends who are forensic psychologists who we go out for. I drink beer, they drink wine, and we have a natter, and they have my back. I know that they solidly have my back, and they will often kind of say to me, kind of like, "You know, when are you going to take some time off with that?" And I think I struggle with drive. I think that's part of that kind of, you know, like my neurodiversity makeup is kind of, you know, do. So I really struggle with it personally. I think I have found problems and are quite open about it that kind of I notice I drink more alcohol when I'm stressed, and then my sleep gets bad, and so I'm not good at like intervening early. But the guys that we train now, all of them have to do, and we as well have to do a wellness action plan, which is like our work will impact. The HCPC are really clear on that. The work will impact on your well-being. So what are you doing to prevent that from happening? And I think so there's that sense of like, I know how important that is, and I don't model it well. But I hope that what we're doing is building it into a generation of psychologists coming through where that will be managed a lot better than how I manage it, my generation of psychologists. I'm probably one of the worst, I think, of our so I'm sure other people manage it loads better. It's just kind of, it's that, yeah, kind of, I walk my dog and I don't have plants because they die. Plants,
you should plants talk, Nick,
we should talk. They should make a noise, yeah. You know what I mean? Like, can I tell it, we're dying here?
Yeah, okay. Right, well, I'll remember not to be a plant of your own. But okay, so do your organisations find ways of looking after your well-being? I mean, are there systems to have mentors or support or referrals? I mean, that's my next question. I've asked you about yourself, but are there systems within prisons to help support, or within your agencies to help support if things get tough?
I can't speak for other organisations. I would suspect no. I think actually most organisations don't really understand what well-being is. Most of them think it, you know, it's put some fresh fruit in the kitchen and have a massage therapist come in once a week. But that's not what saves your psychological well-being. So I think there's a lot of work to do in this area. You might have a really good... Sorry, go on.
No, sorry. I interrupted. Forgive me, Jen.
That's all right. I'm happy to stop because you know what I'm like. I could talk about this a lot. All I would say is at Petros, we're very, very good at looking after our staff.
Yeah. So it's a small but perfectly formed organization. Julie, what about American state corrections organizations? Are you good at supporting each other and thinking about the trauma that staff might go through?
I would say in general it's more informal. I mean, I think large agencies have employee assistance programs, so people can call up to get connected to a therapist if they choose to. But I'm thinking through my roles and my other colleagues and what they've done. I think it's more an informal approach to supporting each other and not an organized approach from an agency. I mean, I think I'll pause there because I'm not really sure what else to say. I haven't really looked at the organization to help me with my well-being. I've thought it was my own responsibility. So then I'm wondering if I'm not tapping into maybe some of the supports that exist.
To a certain extent, some organizations make it the individual's responsibility so that they can wash their hands of it. And also, if you express weakness, I'm not coping very well now, then that becomes a negative, doesn't it? In, say, your university, Nick, or within clinical psychology, forensic psychology, in the UK, are there good support systems by organisations or not?
I would say there's some really good examples of this coming through now, but I don't know how I don't know how standardized that is. So there's definitely the HCPC standards make it really clear. You have to do this. All qualified psychologists, all trained, those in training have to think about well-being. So I am now thinking about well-being, despite it not being something that I've been very good at for my whole life. So we've all got to do that. And I think there's some good examples of organisations now who offer things like a 4-day working week, you know, like that's built, and the evidence around that is around productivity, but also around well-being. So there are some really good examples of this. But you're right. And I remember working with someone called Noreen Tirani, who's like, this is her thing as well, around what organisations do to in critical kind of scenarios, if you like. In forensic psychology, we'd be one of those people who are exposed to trauma, that it is the organisation's responsibility to make sure that staff are not harmed by their work. So, you know, we see that, don't we? You don't see people lifting up heavy weights anymore because of your physical injury that can cause. So it's definitely the organization's responsibility, as well as the individual's responsibility, to protect the health of people doing this role.
I think if you liken it to physical health and safety, and we talk about psychological health and safety, if we know that we are going to put people in physical danger as part of their job, we really prepare them, we train them, we give them equipment, we make sure they're rested, we make sure their energy is at the right level. You wouldn't send somebody into a fire, for example, without having breathing apparatus and protective clothing and all the other things that go with that. And psychologically, I think you can do the same. So whilst there might be services where you can pick up the phone and get some support if you're feeling wobbly, what are we doing to stop people feeling wobbly? You know, because we wouldn't tolerate it in physical health and safety terms to say, oh, you go and fight that fire without all the equipment you need to do it because it's your responsibility. You know, we just wouldn't accept it, and nor should we with psychological health and safety. But we need to understand individual differences. I mean, you've illustrated it brilliantly, Nick. You've said, I'm not very good at this. And there will be lots of people who are not very good at thinking about their own well-being. Largely, people in this field will be very driven to think about everyone else's well-being and not their own. Yeah, but yeah, as we all know, you can't pour from an empty jug. You've got to put your own oxygen mask on first. There are really good professional reasons for people making sure that every step of the way they are taking the precautions they need to take to keep themselves psychologically safe. So that might be, for example, I had a hideous row with my partner last night and I'm coming into work and I've got to go and work with a man who's been accused of domestic violence or charged with domestic violence. Am I in a psychologically fit state to do that? Should I be doing that work? I need to talk to my supervisor, my manager, my mentor, my colleague to say, actually, I'm not, I think I'm okay, but I would really appreciate a little bit of extra support to do this piece of work today. And yet we don't, because we kind of, and I'm going to be a bit critical actually, but we sort of think of ourselves as a bit immune, a bit superhero-y, you know, that we can just carry on and do this work. And actually, without being really paying attention to our own psychological well-being, how on earth can we be effective working with other people, talking about their psychological well-being, their psychological risks, their psychological health and safety? So we have to get better at it. And organisationally, the organisation has a very big role to play when it recruits people, when it trains people, when it supports them through their working week, month, year, making sure people take their leave, making sure people are using all the resources available. I mean, honestly, as John knows, this is something I could go on and on about. But obviously, if the equipment and all the resources are there, my personal responsibility is to make use of them. And if a firefighter said, oh, I don't need all that equipment, I can go to that fire without using it, they'd probably get sacked. He or she would probably get sacked. And actually, why are we not applying the same rigorous standards to our psychological well-being? So, yeah, don't get me started anymore. I'll stop there.
All right. Well, we'll stop you there.
Good job. Thank
I'm
you.
I'm going to change the subject, but really helpful. And if people are thinking about becoming a forensic psychologist, you need to know you've got to look after yourself before you can help other people. Okay, right. So we're moving into the last phase of the podcast, everybody. So maybe we're going to focus on two or three questions. What do you think the profession's biggest current challenge is? Sort of one-liner. What do you think the biggest current challenge is for forensic psychology? Who'd like to start on that? Yep, go, Nick.
For me, it's diversity. And as there's a big difference between the people who do the work and the people that we work with, both in a gender mix, so 95% of the prison population in the UK are men, and we are very overrepresented as a profession, a female profession, and we are far, far too white. So we, as you can kind of see, we haven't managed to challenge that either today. So we've got a big job to do in terms of increasing the diversity of the profession and addressing some of the structural racism that exists through education and the systemic the other stuff that kind of prevents us from changing that. And I think also diversity in terms of as being quite honest as well. Like we're not people a psychologist doesn't come out of a box like a Barbie, you know, like all of us have our histories. Many of us have been exposed to trauma. As a female profession, the majority of us will have experienced a sexual offence. We may not have reported it ever to the police, but the vast majority of women, in fact, I don't know a woman who's not been subject to a sexual offence. So it's just talking through some of those, you know, traumatic experiences so that when students are thinking about this profession, they're not thinking, oh, I couldn't do that because I've got this traumatic history, or, you know, kind of I'm worried about my own journey in this. Kind of the vast majority of us are carrying that stuff as well. It's that's what I would say.
Two challenges. Okay.
Sorry.
No, that's I'm working with that. Julie, what do you think the biggest challenge for the profession is?
Getting people interested in doing the work. I don't know. It used to be that there was a passion for forensics and everyone wanted to work there. And now I don't really hear the interest anymore. And I don't know where it went. So when I'm thinking of challenges, I'm thinking the resources aren't there in a way that they used to exist. And I feel very fortunate to do this work every day. And I wish that I had more opportunities to tell people, like, this is really compelling work that we do. It's very interesting. It's very rewarding while it is challenging. But getting the word out so that we would have more resources, I think that would be my big challenge.
Okay, attracting people to the job. Joe, what do you think the biggest challenge for forensic psychology is?
I think I feel like I want to skip this question, but while people are talking, I'm thinking more about being even more holistic and collaborating with all the other agencies and resources that we can work with to make psychology an integrated part of every service available to offenders. And that's hard to do, but everything, and we're all people, we've all got psychology, every single one of us, a more psychologically informed approach to the whole life cycle of what we're trying to do, I think is a huge challenge, but a really important one.
Yeah, well, I think that's a brilliant answer. Thank you. If you had somebody who was thinking about becoming a forensic psychologist, so it's back to the Julie question, really, is somebody maybe a bit interested? What advice would you give them?
Do it.
Okay.
No regrets.
Just
at
do
all.
It. He's a good Nike advert there.
Best career ever. I've absolutely loved it and have no regrets. It teaches you so much about life in general. And what a privilege to be able to be in that world that lots of other people don't get to see or understand.
Okay. Nick?
I would agree. I think kind of and to not try to be the Barbie in a box psychologist. Actually, we're really broad church, and we should be a broad church. And it's so important to keep your authenticity as you do go forward. Like, yeah.
Big word. Staying true to yourself. I like that one.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't pretend to be someone else. You are enough, and who you are is going to bring a special light, if you like, to our profession. Like, yeah. Don't put a shade on that. Yeah.
Super. Thanks. Julie?
Also, before Nick said being authentic, I was going to say being authentic is important because I feel like when you learn in school, you try to be this person. I mean, I remember seeing forensic psychologists and I thought that you cross some kind of threshold and you become that person. And I didn't know how to become that person because I was a little different. And it took a while for me to realize that my own style works for me. I just had to learn how to cultivate that in my approach to work. I would also say that I would tell people to be lifelong learners. If you ever get to the point where you feel like you know everything, then you probably need to take a vacation or something, because I think it's really important to approach the work with some kind of wonder, enthusiasm, and interest in learning more from every experience. And then I would also say be patient, because it's not a straight course to get to the path. And you might kind of wind around or bump around, but you'll end up where it's a good fit, I think, as long as you pursue what feels, you know, appropriate to your skill set and your interests.
Thank you. That's all been really, really beautifully said, and thank you. Now, we do have an international audience, so we're not just talking to American or British people. There are lots of international people who will be listening to this. And I wondered if you could have a last word as we close our podcast and YouTube today to an international audience about how psychologists can contribute to justice.
Wow. That's a huge question, John, for the last one.
I never said it was going to be easy, this.
I'll volunteer to go first, and that way there's a worse answer than I can say it's because I went first. But in thinking about psychologists, you know, in the role that I play, I think about the balance of the defendant, the victims, the court, the interaction just with a mental health clinician. If there's a positive interaction with a psychologist, that's going to go a long way for every aspect that person touches. And I don't think I'm articulating this very well, but if it's my desire for someone to maintain treatment after they're involved with me through the hospital system, I should really have a good interaction with them so they see, I want to seek out services. And I think connecting people to services that they need is going to address justice issues in a lot of ways, because they're going to have the services they need. They're not going to recidivate. There will be less victims. So I think just having that psychological connection in a positive way, no matter who we're interacting with, can impact justice.
I've thought of something, actually, and I'm going to attribute this to Dr. Ruth Mann, who maybe some people will know, who very sadly isn't with us anymore. But I remember one of her major ambitions was to train judges, and particularly around victim issues, around offending, and particularly sex offending. And I think one of our contributions to justice overall might be to work more closely alongside lawyers and judges and magistrates, to impart that kind of psychological knowledge so that they can be psychologically informed as well. I think that would be something perhaps we don't do enough of, although I'm not sure judges are necessarily be very open to being trained. But I do remember it was a really strong will of Ruth's to do that. And in her name, I would like to propose that as a role for psychology and justice.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Strong international message. Nick, last word to you.
Yeah, just talking about Ruth, it made me just think about it. Like Ruth, I remember saying to me, kind of in a nutshell, kind of, let's go and do a bit of good today. And I kind of think hopefully what psychologists can contribute to justice. Let's kind of do a little bit of good today. That's evidence informed. That's ethical. That fits with some values and that works. And I kind of think that's probably what we can offer alongside our criminologists. I don't like the departure that we've had with our criminologist friends. So I think that we can offer that of hope for recovery, doing a little bit of good that promotes a positive change in people's lives, and by doing that, that reciprocates out into society, hopefully for a safer society.
we're ending on a note of hope, everybody. And I'd like to give a big thank you to our conversationalists today, to Nick Bowes, to Julie Oliver, and to Joe Clark. I'm really hoping everybody's found that of interest, but also been stirred up to think more broadly about the role of forensic psychology. We're planning to do other Just Psychology podcasts in the coming year, and we hope that you'll keep in touch with INCJ and find out what we're going to do next. Thanks to everybody for attending, for contributing, watching or listening, and we hope you've enjoyed this session of Just Psychology. Do encourage your colleagues to listen, to join in the conversation, and to visit the INCJ website at criminaljusticenetwork.net. Goodbye, everybody, and stay safe.
You have been listening to the INCJ podcast, conversations about international criminal justice. To find out more, go to our website at criminaljusticenetwork.net or follow us on Twitter at INTCJ Network.